satisfied with that. "Give us a theory," they would say. "Where's the narrative? Why September 11th? Isn't that the first thing a brilliant man like Jude Garrett would ask?" And they were right, of course. Of all the days, why that one? I thought that if I was Garrett, which fortunately I was, I would tell them... A startling thought swept into my head. Pressured by my imaginary performance, I had an idea of why, when everyone else was running, she was looking for a place to stay. Say there was somebody she wanted to murder, but she had never known how to do it without being caught. Just assume she worked in one of the Twin Towers and was running late that morning. Say she wasn't at her desk, but was standing outside and saw the buildings burn and fall. If all her work colleagues were dead, who would know she had survived? She could just vanish. All she needed was a place to stay, and to make certain that nobody ever recognized her. Then she could commit the murder whenever it suited her. I mean, there's no better alibi than being dead, is there? Chapter 27. Although I met Ben and Marcy for dinner the following night, I said nothing to Ben about my newly minted theory. I wanted to keep turning it over in my mind like some complex architectural model to see if it held together. In return for Marcy's home-cooked meals, I had invited them to Nobu, and somewhere between the shrimp tempura and the yellowtail, I did, however, mention that I had changed my mind. I would be happy to take part in the seminar. They both stared at me. It was Marcy who spoke first.
"Let me guess, you found Jesus, too?"
I smiled, but men being men, there was no way I was going to embarrass either myself or Bradley by talking about the shrine I had seen at Ground Zero and the emotions I had experienced when I read about his bravery. "Maybe it's being home again," I said, "but I think it's time to give something back to the community." Bradley almost choked on his sake. He and Marcy exchanged a glance.
"That's wonderful," Bradley said. "Why not join Neighborhood Watch, too? Just out of curiosity, any chance of telling us the real reason?"
"Not really," I replied, smiling back, thinking quietly about the 67 floors and the fact that the man in the wheelchair, to judge by his photo, was a heavyset guy. The silence stretched on, and at last Marcy realized I had no intention of explaining any more, and she launched into a new subject.
"Have you thought about going back to your childhood home?" she asked.
Surprise changed sides. I stared at her like she was crazy. "Greenwich, you mean? What, press the intercom and ask the corporate raider if I could take a look around?"
"You can try that if you like, but having met him, I don't think it'll work," she said. "I just thought you might have seen the bit in New York Magazine."
I lowered my glass of water and looked a question at her.
"My local garden society is showing the grounds to raise money for charity," she explained. "If you're interested, Ben and I would be happy to go with you."
My mind was spinning. Go back to Greenwich? But I didn't pause. "No, but thanks. It's just a house, Marcy. It doesn't mean anything to me. It was all a long time ago." Naturally, as soon as we had separated after dinner, I bought a copy of the magazine, and the next day, I called the Connecticut Horticultural Society and purchased a ticket. Bill would have loved it.
$200 to see a few trees? What's wrong with Central Park?"
It was a glorious Saturday morning, the sun climbing in a cloudless sky as I wound through Connecticut's leafy avenues. I could have told the cab to take me up the drive to the front of the house, but I wanted to walk. I figured it would be best to give the memories a chance to breathe. The huge wrought iron gates were open, and I gave my ticket to an old lady with a rosette and stepped into the past. It was amazing how little had changed in 20 years. The sycamore still formed a canopy over the pea gravel drive, the European beeches continued to add depth to the hillsides, and in their cool glades the rhododendrons were as beautiful as ever. Halfway up the drive, there was a break in the foliage, designed to give visitors their first view of the house. If it was meant to shock, it never failed. I paused and looked again at Avalon. It stood in the distance, its facade reflected in the broad waters of the ornamental lake. Bill's grandfather had gone to England in the 1920s and stayed with the Astors at Cliveden, their stunning Italianate pile on the Thames. He returned with dozens of photos, showed them to his architect, and told him to build something like that, only more beautiful. The house was finished 6 months before the crash. Along with Marjorie Merriweather Post's Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, it was the last of the great American mansions of the 20th century. My eye tracked along its walls of Indiana limestone, aglow in the morning light, and found the three tall windows at the northern end. It was my bedroom, and maybe you can imagine how a room like that felt to a kid from my part of Detroit. The memory of those frightening days carried my eyes down to the lake, where I'd spent so much time walking alone. Under a row of pin oaks, I saw the grass promontory from which, years later, Bill taught me to sail. As a child, he had spent his summers in Newport and fell in love with the 12-meter yachts which competed for the America's Cup. One day, he came home with scale models of two of the greatest boats ever to have had keels laid down. Australia II and Stars and Stripes were over 5 feet long, their sails and rudders remotely controlled, driven only by the wind and the skill of the operator. God knows how much they cost. I can still see the madman now, sprinting down the lake, trimming his sails, trying to cover my wind and beat me around every buoy. Only when I had defeated him 3 times in a row did he take me out on Long Island Sound and teach me the real thing in a 2-man dinghy. I don't think I'm a boastful person, so maybe you will trust me when I say that sailing was the one thing for which I had a natural gift. Apart from deceit, of course. So much so that one Saturday, sitting on the upturned hull, Bill told me he thought I had a chance of going to the Olympics. Knowing I always kept myself apart from others, he had the good sense to suggest one of the solo classes, a laser, and worked hard with me every weekend. It didn't matter in the end. When I was about 16, lost and angry about life, having nothing else to rebel against, I gave it up. I told him I wasn't going to sail again, and I thought in my naivete and cruelty that the look of disappointment on his face was some form of victory. 100 times I must have thought of ways to take it back, but I wasn't smart enough to understand that an apology is a sign of strength, not weakness, and the opportunity vanished with the summer. As I stood on the drive after so many years and looked at the lake again, I realized why I'd come back. He was dead, but I wanted to talk to him. I made my way up to the old house. Marquees for the silver service lunch stood on the lawns, and the doors into the house were roped off. Only committee members and VIP guests with passes were making it past the security guards. Getting inside might have presented a problem for even a highly trained agent, but not to someone who had spent their childhood in the house. At the back of the service buildings, I found the door into a gardener's change room had been left unlocked, moved through it quickly, and entered the cavernous garage. On the wall on the far side, I reached above a set of workshop shelves and hit a button hidden under a row of power sockets. A section of the shelves creaked open. An underground passage led into the house. Built by Bill's father, ostensibly to access the garage in icy weather, its real purpose was far different. According to the old housekeeper, the colonel, having conquered Europe with the 6th Army, came home and launched a similar campaign with the maids. He established his headquarters on the daybed in his study, a room which offered a long view of the drive and gave that week's subject plenty of time to get herself dressed, head down the passage and into the garage before the colonel's wife reached the front door. The housekeeper always said the plan was so good her boss should have made general. I paused in the passage and listened for any sound from the study. Nothing. So I turned the handle and stepped through the door concealed in the room's antique paneling. Grace would have had a coronary. Gone were her priceless English antiques and the Versailles parquetry, replaced by plaid couches and a tartan carpet. Over the old fireplace, acquired from some chateau, where her finest canaletto had once hung, was a portrait of the owner and his family, staring at some far-off point as if they had just discovered the new world. The only possible improvement would have been if it were painted on black velvet. Ignoring their heroic gaze, I crossed the room and opened the door into the entrance hall. I heard voices. All the good and the great were congregating in the formal living rooms, but the two gorillas at the front door had their backs to the interior, so they didn't see me head up the stairs. At the top, it was one of those moments. The raider hadn't turned his decorator loose on the first floor, so the years promptly fell away, and my childhood was all around me. I walked down the beautiful corridor. I think I said it was the quietest house I had ever known, and opened the door at the north end. The layout of the rooms was unchanged, the weight of the past almost palpable. A large sitting room, a bathroom, walk-in closets, and a bedroom overlooking the woodland. There were a dozen other similar suites in the house, and it was obvious the raider's family had never used this one. I stood silently for minutes without end, just remembering, until at last I perched on the bed and looked at a seat built into a bay window. Whenever Bill came to talk, he always sat there, his face framed against the copper beech trees in the woods behind. Slowly, I let the focus of my vision blur, and I swear it was as if I could see him again. In my heart, I told him all the things I had never been able to say in life. I said he had cared for me when he'd had no obligation of blood or friendship to do so, and I told him that, to my mind, if there was a heaven, there would always be a place for someone who did that for a child. I confess that whatever good was in me came from him, but the acres of darkness were all my own, and I told him that he was forever in my thoughts, and there wasn't a day went by when I didn't wish I could go sailing again to make him proud. I asked for his forgiveness, for not being the son he had so desperately wanted, and after that, I sat in stillness. If anybody had walked in and seen me with my head bowed, they would have thought I was praying, and I must have stayed like that for a long time, because the thing that stirred me was the sound of a violin. The $200 had bought not only the silver service lunch, but an accompaniment by a chamber ensemble, and I guessed everybody was starting to head into the tents. I stood up, took one last look at my past, and headed for the door. Chapter 28. I came down the stairs and was halfway across the foyer, 20 feet from the front door in freedom, when I heard her.
Scott? Scott Murdoch, is that you?
The voice was familiar, but I couldn't put a face to it. I kept walking. Another few paces and I would be safe, swept up in a crowd approaching the exit. 4 paces now. 3. Her hand caught hold of my elbow and brought me to a stop.
Scott, didn't you hear me?
I turned and recognized her. She was wearing the purple rosette of a committee member, and I realized I should have known she would be there. She had always loved gardens. It was the one thing she and Grace had in common, and it was the primary reason for their friendship. "Oh, hello, Mrs. Corcoran," I said, smiling as best I could. She happened to be Dexter's mother, the creep who had been on the Caulfield squash team with me, and I had suffered through any number of team-building events at her house.
"I can't believe it's you. What are you doing here?"
she asked. "You know, just looking around, for old time's sake," I replied. Her eyes flicked across my jacket and failed to find the identity tag that would have given me entry. I could tell she was desperate to ask how the hell I had got past security, but she decided to let it ride.
"Walk me to lunch," she said, linking arms with me. "We'll catch up on everything, then I'll introduce you to the owner. Delightful man."
Her voice dropped conspiratorially.
"Nothing he doesn't know about the markets."
But I didn't move, an edge to my voice. "No, I was just leaving, Mrs. Corcoran. I've seen everything I wanted to." She looked at me, and I think in that instant she realized the visit had meant something important to me. She smiled.
"You're right. Silly of me. Forget the owner. He's an awful man, to be honest. The wife's even worse. Fancies herself a decorator."
Her laugh had always been brittle, like a glass breaking, and it hadn't altered. She took a step back and ran her eye up and down.
"You look well, Scott. The years have been good to you."
"You too," I said, shaking my head in fake wonder. You've barely changed. I couldn't believe I was saying it, but she nodded happily. Flattery and delusion were part of the air she breathed. We continued to look at each other for an awkward moment, neither of us quite sure what to say next. "How's Dexter?" I asked, just to get over the hurdle. A shadow of confusion fell across the tightly drawn skin of her face.
"That's strange. Grace said she wrote to you about it."
I had no idea what she meant. I didn't have any contact with Grace for years. Wrote to me about what?
"That'd be Grace," she said, doing her best to smile. "Not interested unless it was about her. Dexter's dead, Scott."
For a moment, I couldn't get the gears to mesh. It was a strong guy, always sneering at people, but still, dead? That was a bit extreme. Because I was an outsider who never spoke to anyone and he was loathed, the rest of the squash team always made sure we were paired together, and more than anyone, I had to endure his racket throwing and taunts. His mother was watching my face, and I was thankful I didn't have to fake it. I was genuinely shocked. She herself was fighting to blink back the tears. No easy thing, given how much skin the plastic surgeons had cut away over the years.
"I asked Grace to tell you because I knew how tight you two were," she said. "He was always saying how often you would go to him for advice, not just on the court, either."
Corcoran said what? I would have rather gone to Bart Simpson for advice. Jesus Christ.
"We can be honest now, Scott. You didn't belong, did you? Dexter said that's why he always stepped forward to partner you. He didn't want you to feel like you were excluded. He was always very thoughtful like that."
I nodded quietly. "That was a part of Dexter a lot of people didn't see," I said. "I mean, what else could I do? He was her only child, for God's sake." "What happened?"
"He drowned. He was at the beach house by himself and went for a swim one night."
I knew the stretch of beach. It was dangerous even in daylight. Nobody in their right mind would go swimming there in the dark. Fragments of things I had heard drifted back. He had flunked out of law school, ugly stories about hard drinking, time spent at a rehab clinic in Utah.
"Of course there were spiteful rumors," his mother said. "You know what people are like, but the coroner and the police both agreed it was an accident."
I remembered his grandfather had been a prominent judge on the Supreme Court, and I figured somebody had put the fix in. If there was a note in the house, I suppose it was handed privately to his parents and they destroyed it. I've had too much experience of death for someone my age, but even that couldn't inoculate me. I always thought it would be me, but Corcoran, the dumb son of a bitch, was the first of my class to pass from this world, and it must have taken the color from my face.
"You're pale," Mrs. Corcoran said, touching my arm to comfort me. "I shouldn't have said it so directly, but, Scott, I don't know any correct..."
She was swallowing hard, and I thought she was going to cry, but thankfully she didn't. Instead, she forced herself to brighten.
"And what about you? Still in the art business?"
Grief hadn't unhinged her. That was the legend I had created for friends and family when I first went into the field for the division. Legally, nobody was allowed to know of the agency's existence, so I had spent months crafting my cover story before the director finally signed off on it. Arriving at Avalon unannounced one Sunday, I told Grace and Bill over lunch that I was sick of Rand, sick of research, sick of psychology itself. I said the greatest thing the two of them had given me was an interest in art, and as a result, I was leaving Rand to start a business dealing in early 20th century European paintings, basing myself in Berlin. As legends went, if I do say so myself, it was good. It allowed me to travel anywhere in Europe for my real work and at the same time provided a reason to lose contact with my former acquaintances until I was virtually forgotten. And, obviously, it had been believable. Here I was, so many years later, listening to a woman who had been a friend of Bill and Grace asking me about the art racket. I smiled. "Yes, still chasing canvases, Mrs. Corcoran. Still squeezing out a living." She looked from my cashmere sweater down to my expensive loafers, and I realized my mistake. Out of deference to Bill's memory, I had dressed up for the occasion.
I suspect more than squeezing, she said, eyes narrowing.
I didn't want her to think my fictitious business was successful, or else people might start asking why they had never heard of it, so I took the almost revolutionary step of telling the truth. I was lucky, I said. Maybe you already know. Grace left me some money. She paused.
I would have bet everything I owned against that, she said softly.
Yeah, she could be pretty aloof, I replied. But underneath, I suppose she must have felt something.
Obligation, if you ask me, she replied tartly. They're dead now, so I don't suppose it matters. Grace never wanted you, Scott, not even from the beginning.
Whatever difficulties I'd had with my stepmother, I had never expected to hear it put so bluntly. I wondered if Mrs. Corcoran was exaggerating, and a look of doubt must have crossed my face.
Don't stare at me. I heard her say it, about a week after you arrived from Detroit. We were having coffee out there.
She pointed towards the lawn that overlooked the lake.
Bill, Grace, and I were watching you. The nanny had you down at the water's edge, looking at the swans, I think.
As young as I was, I remembered that. I had never seen swans before, and I thought they were the most beautiful things in the world.
Bill wouldn't take his eyes off of you, Mrs. Corcoran continued. To be honest, I'd never seen a man so taken with a child. Grace noticed it, too. She kept looking at him, and then, very quietly, she said, I've changed my mind, Bill. A child doesn't fit in with us. He turned to her. You're wrong, he said. It's exactly what we need. More kids. Give this place some damn life. There was a finality to it, but Grace wouldn't let it drop, determined to have her way. Apparently, they only had a few days to tell the agency if they were going to keep you.
Mrs. Corcoran paused to see my reaction. What did she expect? Is there anyone who doesn't want to think their parents loved them? Yeah, Grace was an experienced shopper, I said. She took everything on a sale or return basis. The old woman laughed.
That's why I always liked you, Scott. You never let anything hurt you.
I just nodded.
Anyway, the argument between them became increasingly bitter until finally Grace lost her temper. You know your trouble, Bill, she said. You're a porter. You see anyone with baggage, and you've always got to help them. With that, she told him you'd be leaving in the morning and headed for the house, claiming she was going to check on Munch. Nobody saw her for the rest of the day. Bill sat in silence for a long time, his eyes still fixed on you. Then he said, Scott will be staying at Avalon until he goes to college. Longer, if he wants. He'll stay because the porter says so, and Grace will have to accept it. I didn't know what to say. I'd never seen that steely side of him. I'm not sure anybody had. Then he turned to me and said the strangest thing. You probably know Bill wasn't a spiritual man. I never once heard him talk about God. But he said that every night he sat by your bed while you slept. I think Scott was sent to us, he told me. I feel like I've been chosen to care for him. I don't know why I think it, but I believe he's going to do something very important one day.
Standing in the old house with so many years gone by, Mrs. Corcoran smiled at me.
Did you, Scott? Was Bill right? Did you do something very important?
I smiled back and shook my head. Not unless you think finding a few lost canvases is important. But Bill was a fine man, and it was good of him to think like that. From out on the lawn, we heard someone calling Mrs. Corcoran's name. She probably had to give a speech. She patted my arm, starting to go.
Well, who knows, she said. You're not old. There's still time, isn't there? Goodbye, Scott.
But there wasn't. Time, I mean. I was still in my 30s, but my race was run. Only a fool would think it could turn out otherwise. So, say hello to the fool, I have often said to myself when I think back on those days. Chapter 29. The Saracen, newly arrived in Afghanistan, was traveling fast, sticking to the sparsely populated valleys for as long as he could, always heading east. It had been almost 15 years since he had been in the country as a teenage mooj, but every day he still saw evidence of the old Soviet war. Abandoned gun emplacements, a rusted artillery piece, a goat herder's hut bombed into oblivion. Creeks and rivers ran along the valley floors, and they provided safety. The fertile strip on either side of the watercourses was planted with only one thing, marijuana, and the tall, moisture-heavy plants provided good cover for U.S. thermal imaging equipment. Finally, however, he had to abandon the valleys and climb into the forbidding Hindu Kush Mountains. In the steep forests, he followed the tracks made by timber cutters, hoping the surveillance drones would see his pack horses and dismiss him as one more illegal logger. But above the tree line, every breath a labor because of the altitude, there was no cover, and he had to quicken his pace even more. Late one afternoon, in the distance, he thought he saw the mountain scree where he had brought down his first Hind gunship, but it was a long time ago and he couldn't be sure. Toiling higher, he crossed a narrow ridge and passed shell casings and rocket pods of a far more recent vintage. In the years since he had last seen the country as a Muj, the Afghans had known little but war. The Russians had been replaced by the warlords. Mullah Omar's Taliban had defeated the warlords. America, hunting Osama bin Laden, had destroyed the Taliban. The warlords had returned. And now the U.S. and a coalition of allies were fighting to prevent the reemergence of the Taliban. The used ammunition told him he must be close to Kunar province, referred to by the Americans as Enemy Central, and sure enough, that night he heard Apache helicopters roaring down a valley below, followed by an AC-130 gunship, which people said fired bullets as big as Coke bottles. In the following days, he was stopped numerous times, mostly by U.S. or NATO patrols, but twice by wild men who described themselves as members of the anti-coalition militia, but who he knew were Taliban in a different turban. He told them all the same thing. He was a devout Lebanese doctor who had raised money from mosques and individuals in his homeland for a medical mercy mission. His aim was to bring help to Muslims in remote areas where, because the continuous wars had destroyed the country's infrastructure, there were no longer any clinics and the doctors had fled. He said he had sent his supplies by boat from Beirut to Karachi, flown to join them, bought a truck, driven through Pakistan into Afghanistan, and at the Shadal Bazaar, the world's largest opium market, had traded the truck for the ponies. All of it was true, and he even had a cheap digital camera on which he could show photos of himself tending to the sick and inoculating kids at a dozen ruined villages. That, combined with the fact that every time his caravan was searched, they found a wide range of medical supplies, allayed both sides' fears. The only items he carried that led to questions were a pane of thick, reinforced glass and several sacks of quicklime. He told anyone who asked that the glass was used as an easily sterilized platform on which to mix prescriptions. And the quicklime? How else was he to destroy the swabs and dressings he used to treat everything from gangrene to measles? Nobody even bothered to reach deep into the small saddlebag which held his clothes and spare sandals. At the bottom of it was a collapsible helmet with a clear plastic faceplate, a box of R-700D disposable face masks, a black biohazard suit, rubber boots, Kevlar-lined gloves, and rolls of special tape to seal every join from the helmet to the boots. If the equipment had been found, he would have told them that anthrax occurs naturally among hoofed animals, including goats and camels, and that he had no intention of dying for his work. As further proof, he would have shown them vials of antibiotics he was carrying, stolen from the hospital he had been working at in Lebanon, which was the standard drug to treat the disease. But the men he ran into were soldiers, either guerrillas or otherwise, and they were looking for weapons and explosives, and nobody asked. The only time he straight out lied was if they asked where he was heading next. He would shrug, point at his possessions, and say he didn't even have a map.
"I go wherever God takes me."
But he did have a map. It was inside his head, and he knew exactly where he was going. On three separate occasions, NATO troops, having searched him, helped load his supplies back onto the ponies. The hardest part was lifting and securing the pairs of heavy-duty truck batteries onto the four animals at the rear. The batteries were used to power small, refrigerated boxes, and the soldiers smiled at the doctor's ingenuity. Inside were racks of tiny glass bottles which would help countless children. vaccines against polio, diphtheria, and whooping cough. Hidden among them, indistinguishable except by an extra zero he had added to the batch number, were a pair of bottles which contained something vastly different. At that time, only two examples of the smallpox virus were supposed to exist on the planet. Kept for research purposes, one was in a virtually impenetrable freezer at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, and the other was at a secure Russian facility called Vector in Siberia. There was, however, a third example. Unknown to anyone in the world except the Saracen, it was in the two glass vials on the back of his wiry pack horse deep in the Hindu Kush. He hadn't stolen it. He hadn't bought it from some disaffected Russian scientist. It hadn't been given to him by a failed state like North Korea, which had undertaken its own illegal research. No. The remarkable thing was that the Saracen had synthesized it himself. In his garage. Chapter 30. He could never have done it without the internet. As the search for him became increasingly desperate, I finally discovered that, several years after he had graduated in medicine, the Saracen took a job at El Mina, an ancient town in the north of Lebanon. He worked the night shift in ER at the local hospital, hard and exhausting work in a facility that was under-equipped and understaffed. Despite the constant fatigue, he used every spare moment to secretly pursue what he considered his life's work, jihad against the far enemy. While other soldiers of Allah were wasting their time at hidden boot camps in Pakistan or fantasizing about getting a U.S. visa, he was reading everything he could find about weapons of mass destruction. And it was only the internet that had given a doctor at an old hospital in a town nobody had heard of widespread access to the latest research into every major biological killer in the world. In one of those unforeseen but deadly consequences, what the CIA would call blowback, the World Wide Web had opened up a Pandora's box of terrible possibilities. The Saracen hadn't been raised like Western kids, so he didn't know much about computers, but he knew enough. By using a good proxy connection, he managed to undertake his relentless search in complete anonymity. For months, helped by his knowledge of medicine and biology, he concentrated on what he considered the most achievable biowarfare candidates: ricin, anthrax, pneumonic plague, sarin, tabin, and soman, all of which were capable of causing widespread death and even greater panic. But all of them came with enormous shortcomings. Most of them either weren't infectious or were most effective if used as part of an aerial bombing campaign. Frustrated at his lack of progress, fighting waves of despair, he was in the middle of researching anthrax. At least the raw bacteria was obtainable. It was widespread in the Middle East, including Lebanon, but it would still have to be weaponized, when he read something that changed the very nature of the world in which we live. Nobody much noticed it. In the online pages of the Annals of Virology, a monthly which doesn't exactly fly off the shelves, was an account of an experiment conducted at a lab in upstate New York. For the first time in history, a life form had been built entirely from off-the-shelf chemicals, all purchased for a few hundred dollars. It was late in the afternoon, and for once the Saracen forgot to kneel for Maghrib, the sunset prayer. With increasing wonder, he read that the scientists had successfully recreated the polio virus from scratch. According to the article, the aim of the researchers was to warn the U.S. government that terrorist groups could make biological weapons without ever obtaining the natural virus. Good idea. There was at least one terrorist who had never thought of it until he read their research. Even more alarming, or perhaps not, depending on your degree of cynicism, was the name of the organization which had funded the program with a $300,000 grant. The Pentagon. The Saracen, however, was certain that the startling development had nothing to do with the Defense Department or scientists in New York. They were merely the instruments. This was Allah's work. Somebody had now synthesized a virus and opened the door for him. On the other side was the holy grail of all bioterror weapons, a wildly infectious agent transmitted by the simple act of breathing, the most potent killer in the history of the planet. Smallpox. In the weeks which followed, the Saracen learned that the researchers, using polio's publicly available genome, its genetic map, had purchased what are called nucleic acid base pairs from one of the scores of companies that sell material to the biotech industry. Those base pairs cost the princely sum of 10 cents apiece, and, according to an account on an internet discussion forum for biology geeks, were ordered by email. Because the sales company's online system was fully automated, the report on the forum said, there was no name verification, and nobody asked why the material was being purchased. Once the New York lab had acquired the microscopic building blocks, the scientists spent a year arranging them in the correct order, and then, in a skillful but publicly known process, gluing them together. The Saracen, being a doctor and with a dozen manuals on molecular biology at hand, soon understood enough of the process to suspect that what could be done at a lab in upstate New York could be duplicated in a garage in Elmina, if he could locate one thing. He had read about it somewhere, and he started searching. After 2 hours online, he found it. The smallpox genome. Once one of the world's most closely guarded secrets, the virus's complete chemical and genetic map had fallen victim to the explosion of knowledge about biology and the worldwide dissemination of complex scientific papers over the internet. There were no gatekeepers anymore, and potentially lethal information was hemorrhaging all the time. While it had taken the Saracen 2 hours to locate the genome, had he been more experienced at searching the web, he would have found it on a dozen biology or research sites in less than half the time. I know, because I did. From the article in the Annals of Virology, the Saracen knew that polio had 7,741 base pairs, or letters, in its genome. Now he saw that smallpox had 185,578 letters, greatly enhancing the difficulty of recreating it. But he was riding a wave of knowledge and optimism, and he wasn't going to let a small thing like an extra 178,000 letters deter him. He quickly decided his first objective was to protect himself. Smallpox is a merciless pathogen, and it was almost certain that somewhere in the complicated and unstable process of trying to synthesize it, he would make a mistake. Many mistakes, probably, and the first he would know of his exposure would be when the fever hit and, a short time later, a rash of fluid-filled blisters appeared. By then, it would be over. No cure for smallpox has ever been found. He had to locate a vaccine, and it was the pursuit of that goal that made him take a 6-week vacation. Instead of heading to Beirut and flying to Cairo to visit friends, as he had told the medical director of the hospital, he had boarded an early morning bus for Damascus. There, he killed Klaas, stole the vaccine, used the double-pronged needle on himself, and crossed the border back into Lebanon. He spent 5 days locked in a hotel room fighting the terrible fever which had accompanied the huge dose of vaccine he had taken. Once that had passed and the telltale scab and scar had formed on his arm, he returned to Elmina. Though outwardly nothing had changed, his life had entered an entirely new phase. He was ready to start on his history-making journey. Chapter 31. The first thing he did was set about sealing the garage under a small apartment and turning it into a makeshift biocontainment laboratory. He had one advantage in performing the work. There was a good example close at hand. While everything else at Elmina Hospital was falling apart, it had a 2-bed isolation ward and an attached lab. Because anthrax was endemic to the region, the hospital had been able to take advantage of a World Health Organization program to help developing nations combat the disease. Forget that the hospital didn't have some of the most rudimentary equipment necessary for saving lives. The Geneva organization had provided a small fortune to build a first-rate facility. As far as the Saracen knew, it had only been used once in 10 years, and had become little more than a temporary storage shed. Nevertheless, it was an excellent blueprint for his own lab, and it also ended up providing half the practical equipment he needed. Incubators, a microscope, culture dishes, pipettes, sterilizing cabinets, and a host of other items. They were never even reported missing. Over the following week, using a computer and an internet connection he had set up in the lab, he assembled a list of over 60 biotech companies worldwide which would provide DNA material of fewer than 70 letters without asking for name verification or any further information. A long time later, on first hearing this, I didn't believe it. To my despair, I went online and did it myself. But before the Saracen could order DNA, he had to locate two crucial pieces of equipment. Gene synthesizers. Machines about the size of a decent computer printer. It took him an hour. The dizzying progress in the biotech industry meant the market was awash with equipment at hugely discounted prices, which was no longer the fastest or the best. He found two synthesizers in excellent condition, one on eBay, the other on usedlabequipment.com. Combined, they cost under $5,000, and the Saracen was thankful that doctors were well paid and he had always lived such a frugal life. He could well afford them from his savings, and what was even more important to him was that the sellers also had no interest in who the purchaser was. All they wanted was a valid credit card number. An anonymous Western Union money transfer was just as good. He started work the day the second machine arrived, and that evening he was surfing the web, adding to his already vast library about viruses and biology, when he glanced through the latest online edition of the prestigious periodical Science. One of its lead stories was about a researcher who had just synthesized an organism with 300,000 letters. In the short time since he had decided on his course of action, 185,000 letters had already faded into history. That was the pace at which genetic engineering was advancing. After he finished the article, he knew that smallpox was within his grasp, and his date with destiny confirmed. He prayed late into the night. It was a huge responsibility, and he asked Allah to make sure he used it well. 6 months later, having glued and re-glued, backtracked, researched, and relearned, using not only his knowledge but the vast array of cheap equipment that was rapidly becoming available, he completed his task. To the best of his ability, one molecule at a time, he had recreated smallpox. According to every test he could run, it was identical to its naturally occurring equivalent. In the thousands of years since the virus had made the jump from some other life form into humans, there had been two different types of smallpox. Variola minor, often called cottonpox, which was rarely fatal, and its bigger brother, variola major, the disease which had proved devastating to human populations ever since mankind had started to congregate in large tribes. It was that virus, with a death rate of about 30%, which the Saracen had synthesized. However, within variola major, there were a host of different strains, some far more lethal than others. Knowing that, he began to refine and challenge his virus, a well-established method of forcing it to mutate time after time, attempting, in the slang of some microbiologists, to KFC or deep-fry it, trying to turn it into a red-hot strain of what was already the hottest agent on Earth. Satisfied that it was as lethal as he could make it, he set out to modify its genetic structure. That was the simplest, but also the most dangerous part of the entire exercise. It was also the most necessary. Once the naturally occurring form of smallpox had been eradicated from the planet, the World Health Organization found itself holding a huge stockpile of vaccine doses. After several years, when everyone was convinced that the virus would not reemerge, that protective reservoir was destroyed. Similarly, although a vast number of people had been routinely vaccinated against smallpox, primarily children in the Western world, the Saracen also knew that the vaccine started to wear off after 5 years, and as a result, virtually nobody on Earth had any immunity. That was ideal for his purposes, except for one problem. The United States, the target of his assault, had become increasingly concerned about a bioterror attack, and in the wake of 9/11 had decided to produce and warehouse over 300 million doses of vaccine, one for every person in the country. When the Saracen had first read about it, the information had cast him into despair. Sitting up for an entire night researching vaccination, he learned that anything up to 20% of a population would remain unprotected. The vaccine didn't take in a significant number of people, and it can't be given to pregnant women, newborn babies, elderly citizens, or anyone with a damaged immune system. Even so, the existence of the vaccine stockpile shook him badly, and just before dawn on that long night, he had considered abandoning his plan and looking for a different weapon. But once again, the ongoing explosion of scientific knowledge, or Allah, came to his rescue. Delving deeper into the literature, he found a research report from a group of Australian scientists. Working at a facility in Canberra, the nation's capital, the scientists had been trying to find a way to control the breeding cycle of mice. Working with mousepox, a disease closely related to smallpox, they had spliced a gene from the immune system known as IL-4 into the virus. What they found was startling. The virus crashed through any vaccine that had been given to the mice and wiped them out. The addition of one gene, just one gene, had made the virus into a vaccine buster. The Saracen, with hope renewed, started following the obscure research trail. In rarely visited corners of the web, frequently following nothing more than casual leads mentioned in scientific forums, he found that a number of researchers throughout the world had tried, with varying degrees of success, to duplicate the Australian's result. With daylight flooding into the world outside his cocoon, he worked on and stumbled across a newly posted report from several Dutch agricultural scientists working with cowpox. They had decided to splice a slightly different gene into the virus and had not only succeeded in evading the vaccine, but had managed to repeat the process every time. The Saracen knew that the gene in question was readily available from the same companies that had supplied him with the nucleic acid base pairs. He ordered it immediately, opened the tiny package 2 days later, and took science into uncharted waters. He knew that the massive dose of vaccine that he had used on himself would provide no protection if he was successful in constructing a weapons-grade smallpox virus. He would be as good as naked in the hot zone. As a result, he stole a complete biohazard suit from the hospital to protect himself against infection, and then drove to the coast. He traveled slowly along the road that ran parallel to the sea until he found a diving shop. Inside, he paid cash for 4 scuba tanks of oxygen and an air regulator, loaded them into the back of his car, and returned to his cocoon. Every time he worked on his vaccine-resistant virus, it took him 20 minutes to put on the pilfered biohazard suit and attach his specially modified breathing apparatus. But the scientific work was easy. Partly as a result of the expertise he had gained, and partly because the new gene contained only 300 or so letters, he finished splicing it into the virus less than a month later. It was this potential cataclysm that was contained in the 2 glass vials with the extra zero, and there was a simple reason why the Saracen had brought them to Afghanistan. All his remarkable work would have been for nothing if he had made a mistake and the virus didn't work. He was well aware that smallpox occurred only in humans. Not even our closest relatives, chimpanzees and monkeys, were capable of catching it. That meant the only way for him to be certain it was as deadly as the original and to discover if it could crash through the vaccine was to conduct a human trial. It was deep in the mountains of the Hindu Kush that he planned to find the 3 subjects necessary for his dark experiment. Leaving Kunar Province and its U.S. patrols far behind, he found a dry riverbed which, due to the decay of the country's infrastructure, now served as a road. For days on end, he walked along it, sprayed with dust by passing trucks and the ubiquitous Toyota 4-wheel drives, but finally, on a blazingly hot morning, he realized he was getting close to his destination. Ahead, silhouetted against the sky, he saw 4 men on horseback with AK-47s, standing guard. The Saracen led his small caravan forward, turned a bend in the river, and saw, some distance ahead, a town of mud and stone that appeared little changed since the Middle Ages. On the opposite bank, commanding a pass deeper into the mountains, stood a heavily fortified group of buildings built into a cliff face. Once a 19th-century British fort, it had been turned into a home, a stronghold, and a seat of regional power. The Saracen passed under the remains of a road bridge, climbed onto a pitted blacktop, and headed towards it. Halfway along what had once been a major road, he walked between a jumble of giant boulders and, emerging on the other side, found himself face to face with 2 of the horsemen. They commanded the road, their rifles leveled casually at his chest. The Saracen knew they would be more than happy to pull the trigger.
"Who are you?"
The one with fine gold inlay along the stock of his weapon, the more senior of the pair asked. The Saracen started to answer but stopped, realizing the name he was using, the one on his passport, would mean nothing. Instead, he indicated the entrance to the fort.
"Give him a message, please. Tell him the boy with the blowpipe has returned."
Chapter 32. In the years that had passed since their last meeting, Lord Abdul Muhammad Khan had come to look more like a medieval painting than a warlord. His skin was the texture of tooled leather, and he wore a shepan, the long traditional Afghan robe, of the finest cloth, a gold dagger as a symbol of his authority, and highly polished calfskin boots. Unfortunately, the effect was ruined by a gold Rolex as big as a microwave. The years hadn't been kind to him. Then again, the years are never kind to anyone in Afghanistan. But he could boast of one thing few of his contemporaries could. He was still alive. In his late 60s now, he was the warrior father of his clan, and both soldiers and visitors stood aside in true deference as he limped through his stone-paved compound. All of them wondered who the muscular man was who had arrived at the gate and who Lord Khan had rushed to meet with such speed. Some said he was a former comrade, a Muj hero, while others claimed he was a doctor who had come to treat Khan for some terrible illness. Whatever the stranger's background, he was being afforded an honor denied to any of them. The great Khan had his arm around the man's shoulder, personally escorting him into his ornate audience chamber. The room had once been the office of the British commander of the Northwest Frontier and, as a result, featured high ceilings, a fireplace imported from England, and a raised platform on which had stood the commander's desk. This was now covered with antique carpets fit for a museum and silk cushions that had crossed the border from palaces in Iran and China. A gold brazier burned incense in the corner. The fireplace housed all the equipment for making tea, but of all the exotic and beautiful things in the room, it was the wall opposite the fireplace that monopolized every visitor's attention. Khan watched from beneath hooded eyes as the Saracen caught sight of the massive concrete block set into it. The visitor stopped and stared at the bas-relief of the struggling limbs and screaming faces of the two men who had betrayed Khan, captured forever, crystallized, in the moment of death. For some reason, he had always imagined the men were not much more than boys. But now he saw they were full-fledged warriors, tall and heavily armed, and that made their terror even more powerful. The Saracen walked closer. Age and smoke had given the blocks a patina the glow of honey, and he was surprised at how much they resembled something cast in bronze. Lord Khan came to his side.
"You like my sculpture, huh? You know what their names are."
The Saracen shook his head. Even though he had been told the story many times, he had never heard that part.
"Dumb and dumber,"
the warlord said, and roared with laughter.
"That's what the CIA guy called him when he visited years ago. Now it's the name everyone uses."
The Saracen stiffened slightly.
"Does the CIA come here often?"
"Every few years,"
Lord Khan said with a shrug.
"Always trying to buy my support for whatever faction they're backing that month."
He walked towards the fireplace.
"I've never taken their money, but I have to admit, I like their sense of humor."
An old man sitting cross-legged in the gloom, his eyes misted with cataracts, unfurled himself, about to start preparing tea for his master and the guest. Lord Khan stopped him and turned to the Saracen, indicating the staff and a dozen bodyguards spread around the room.
"You want them to leave?"
The Saracen nodded. Privacy was exactly what he needed. Khan smiled.
"I thought so. Nobody comes to Afghanistan on a social visit."
As the room emptied, he began spooning leaves into a pot.
"You remember the last time I served you tea?" "The war was over,"
the Saracen replied.
"We were striking camp. You and I sat in the kitchen smoking cigarettes."
Lord Khan's face softened. They had been good times, full of comradeship and courage, and he liked to recall them.
"I was heading home, and you were starting on a much longer road."
The Saracen said nothing, taking two delicate cups out of a rack, placing them next to the fire to warm.
The last time I looked,
Lord Khan continued quietly,
the House of Saud still had its palaces and power.
For how much longer?
The Saracen asked, equally softly.
Maybe we'll learn soon enough if they can survive without the help of the far enemy.
The two men looked at one another.
When I heard you were a traveling doctor,
Lord Khan said,
I wondered if you had changed, mellowed as you got older.
His voice trailed off.
So, you are still doing God's work, then?
Always. I need three people, Abdul Muhammad Khan, three dispensable people. If you can help, I am sure God will be well acquainted with what you do.
What do you mean exactly? How dispensable?
The Saracen made no reply. He just turned and looked at Dumb and Dumber.
Oh,
said Lord Khan,
that dispensable.
He needed time to think, so he walked to a balcony overlooking the compound and started yelling orders to the soldiers gathered below. Whatever the risks, he realized he had little choice. The Saracen had been willing to lay down his life for Khan and his people, and that was a debt which could never be repaid. He returned to finish making the tea.
Any preference regarding the prisoners?
He asked.
Jews would be perfect,
the Saracen said. Lord Khan laughed at the joke.
Sure,
he replied.
I'll check the local synagogue.
The Saracen grinned back. They both knew there hadn't been a Jew in Afghanistan in decades, not since the last of the once-flourishing community had been forced to run for their lives.
Seriously,
the Saracen continued,
they have to be young and healthy, and no Muslims. Or Americans,
Lord Khan added.
Abduct one of them, and it brings down a world of grief on everyone.
The Saracen nodded.
If Muslims are excluded, it means it has to be foreigners. So I guess there will be trouble enough without asking for more.
The proposal had one huge chance of success, Lord Khan thought. Afghanistan was awash with potential victims. European aid workers, Christian missionaries, English reconstruction workers, international journalists. Though he said nothing, he also knew men who had been in the kidnapping for ransom business for years. They were a gang of a dozen brothers and cousins who had once fought under his command and now lived across the border in Iran. Just as importantly, they would die for Abdul Muhammad Khan if he asked. He had once saved their mother's life.
One final criterion, the Saracen said. The prisoners don't have to be men.
That pleased Lord Khan. Women made it a lot easier. They were more difficult to abduct, but easier to control and conceal. No foreign soldier would ever dare look beneath a black veil and full-length robe.
Can you give me 3 weeks?
Khan asked. The Saracen couldn't believe it. He would have waited 3 months if he'd had to. Not trusting words to express his gratitude, he reached out and warmly embraced the old warrior. Their business concluded, Lord Khan pulled a bell rope, summoning his staff back into the room. He didn't say it, but the less time he spent with the Saracen alone, the easier it was to disclaim any knowledge of future events.
And what of you, my friend?
He said, as the door opened and his guards entered.
You are blessed with a wife?
Lord Khan was making casual conversation for the benefit of his retainers, but he knew from the shadow of grief that passed across his visitor's face, it was a question which would have been better left unasked.
I was blessed, the Saracen replied softly. Immediately after I graduated as a doctor, I went to Gaza, to the Jabalia refugee camp. I knew that was where the people's need was the greatest.
Several guards and retainers exchanged a glance. Gaza was not somewhere to be taken lightly. It was probably the only place in the world that made Afghanistan look safe.
I had heard a woman lecture about it while I was studying medicine in Beirut. She was the one who introduced me to the idea of the far enemy, the Saracen continued. After I arrived, I found her again. 2 years later, we were married, and then...
His fist clenched, and he shrugged, the simple action conveying more about loss than any words.
How did she die?
Lord Khan asked. Nobody in the room took their eyes off the visitor.
An Israeli rocket. She was a passenger.